Republicans say it is not over until each and every vote has been suppressed. So that's...
That sounds about right, doesn't it? Sorry to say.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, in Cottage Grove on KSO, and in Eugene on KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, in Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I am Brad Friedman, your friendly, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from BradBlog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling episode of what we call The Bradcast. Glad to have you here with us. Donald Trump's finely tuned machine. Is that what he calls it, Desi Doyen? Finally,
yeah.
Well-oiled
something,
machine?
Something stupid like that, yes.
Whatever he calls his administration continues to be a finely tuned dumpster fire today, with reports flying now that he is about to fire his chief of staff, John Kelly, although we've been hearing those reports now for some months. But John Kelly is maybe about to go. His Secretary for Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, is now on the chopping block, and now in what CNN is describing as a stunning move. First Lady Melania Trump, no, she's not being fired, but she has called for the firing of Deputy National Security Advisor Mira Ricardel, who is apparently second in command to Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton. That is, by the way, his third NSA, for those having trouble keeping track. Melania's office put out a statement reading, quote, "It is the position of the Office of the First Lady that Ricardel no longer deserves the honor of serving in this White House." Not sure how much of an honor it actually is, but the idea that a First Lady is putting out a statement calling for an administration official to be fired is, in fact, stunning. I don't know that we've ever seen anything like that.
Yeah, that's bizarre. I'm not even sure what to make of that.
I know. We've run out of adjectives for what's going on here at this point, because at the same time, by the way, CNN is suing the White House in response to the White House banning White House correspondent Jim Acosta from covering the White House. That after they had falsely pretended that he had manhandled an intern during a press conference, despite video showing otherwise, and despite doctored video put out by the White House trying to make the claim that he had done so. So now they're filing a lawsuit. The White House is coming up with a new explanation.
Yes, they've changed their story already. Now they're saying
it now?
That it was because Jim Acosta was rude to his colleagues by not letting them ask questions because he was insisting on continuing to ask the question he was trying to get answered.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what's going on. I don't know that we have ever had such a finely enough tuned machine that we have a first lady publicly calling for an official to be fired after just 7 months on the job, or that a reporter had to be banned from the White House because he asked perfectly legitimate questions of a president that the White House did not like. But that's just some of the mess that continues to burn in Donald Trump's D.C. dumpster fire today. But once again, we are focusing here, at least trying to, on the broadcast, on the continuing news and continuing lawsuits following last Tuesday's critical midterm elections. We'll be joined momentarily by the head of Common Cause Georgia, which won an important lawsuit last night amid the fight to count ballots in the gubernatorial race in Georgia between vote suppressor and just days ago resigned Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp and his challenger for the governor's race, Democrat Stacey Abrams, who is currently just under 1.5 points behind Kemp in what suffices for a vote count in the state of Georgia, with Kemp less than 0.3 percentage point now away from being forced into a runoff election. Also, in a what I think is a separate federal lawsuit, a judge found that Brian Kemp violated the Civil Rights Act by rejecting certain absentee ballots. So that was, I believe, the fourth loss in a federal court over just the past couple of weeks for Brian Kemp. But there are so many lawsuits and challenges at this point against him that I have lost track. Hopefully our guest, the executive director of Common Cause Georgia, can help us make at least some sense of the mess in Georgia today. That's coming up shortly. Also a bit later, Desi Doyen, you'll be here with more disturbing news, I'm sorry to say.
Yes.
Out of these record-breaking California fires, but some encouraging news at least for now, for the moment, concerning the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag today on the Green News Report.
At best. But first, some news out of some of the other states that are still fighting over election results or still counting ballots a week after the midterms. We spoke on this program yesterday with Ion Sancho, the legendary 28-year former supervisor of elections in Leon County, Florida. That's the state's capital of Tallahassee. He had been chosen by both parties to oversee the presidential recount in Florida back in 2000, which was eventually stopped by the U.S. Supreme Court at the behest of Republicans on Team George W. Bush, denying Al Gore at the time what would almost certainly have been a win in Florida, and with it, a win across the country in the Electoral College for the presidency of the United States. Well, that was in 2000, 18 years ago. By the way, I saw someone mention that the 2000 recount is now old enough to have its vote not counted in the 2018 elections. In any event, we have now three statewide recounts going on in Florida in the governor's race between Republican Ron DeSantis and Democrat Andrew Gillum, in the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson and termed out Republican Florida Governor Rick Scott, and even one in the Agriculture Commissioner's race. So it's unprecedented for even one statewide recount to happen in Florida, much less three of them at the same time. But it's Florida, so recount may not mean what you think it means. Right now, it means running all of the hand-marked paper ballots back through the same tabulation computers again, where they'll be tabulated either correctly or incorrectly. No one knows because no one is allowed to physically examine those ballots to find out one way or another. But as Sancho told me, he's a longtime election integrity champion. He finally resigned his post in 2016 in Leon County. As he told me yesterday, it would be physically impossible for Palm Beach County, the most populous and most democratic county in the state, to physically run all of their ballots through the ES&S tabulators in time to meet the state's pretty much arbitrary deadline of this Thursday at 3 p.m. The machines just can't tabulate that many ballots. They can only take stacks of 300 at a time, he told me, and there are hundreds of thousands to be counted. Even if they went around the clock, they probably could not get this done by Thursday in one race, much less three different races. So, you know, and there, as I say, there's no reason, and as Ion said on yesterday's show, there's really no reason for this short deadline. Out here in California, we don't even finish our first count until December, much less a first count and a recount, as they're doing in Florida. So no real reason for that, other than Republicans in the state trying to make it as difficult as possible to count ballots and for the public to know that those ballots have been counted accurately. Well, now with Palm Beach, as he noted, being almost impossible, physically impossible to count those ballots, a similar case most likely in Broward County, where they were a day or so late even beginning this so-called recount. We now have this breaking in Leon County. A Leon County circuit judge is expected to issue an order today extending the deadline for recounts in Palm Beach County until November 20. That's about 5 days after the original 3 p.m. Thursday deadline, according to the Palm Beach Post. The order would include extending the recounting of votes in the U.S. Senate race between Nelson and Scott, in the governor's race between DeSantis and Gillum, and in the race for Agriculture Commission between Democrat Nikki Fried and Republican Matt Caldwell. Those three races, those are the statewide races, as well as a fourth race that is being recounted in Palm Beach County. That one for a state house district between Democrat Jim Bonfiglio and Republican Mike Caruso. Now, the extension for all of those races comes out of a lawsuit filed by Bonfiglio, the Democrat in that House district race. He is currently losing to the Republican by just 37 votes, and he asked the judge to extend either all of the races, extend the so-called recount time, or put his race first, since his race would require less time to actually recount. And now, according to the Palm Beach Post, the judge decided to extend all of the races, at least in Palm Beach.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that, because it does sound like it's crazy to try to force them to count all of these ballots on their crappy machines as fast as they need to be counted,
when they physically cannot be counted that quickly. Bonfiglio said he asked the judge to extend all of these races, and Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections Susan Booker told the Palm Beach Post that her understanding is that whatever the judge orders will be challenged by the Florida Secretary of State in federal courts. Now, Florida's Secretary of State, a man by the name of Ken Detzner, he is hand-selected in Florida by the governor. In this case, Governor Rick Scott, whose lead over Senator Bill Nelson is rapidly disappearing as votes are actually being counted in the state of Florida. Booker said late on Monday night that her staff could complete the recount for the U.S. Senate race by Thursday at 3 p.m., but that would mean that none of the other races could be completed in time. And by the way, in the U.S. Senate race, that will probably extend to Florida's version of a hand count, where they will take the ballots that the computers found either no vote on or too many votes on in the Senate race. Those are set aside. Those are remade onto other paper ballots in case there's a vote that the computer didn't read. And then those paper ballots are run through the machines again.
And they have to do that by law.
That's what is called a manual count in the state of Florida. But Booker, in any event, in Palm Beach, says one race they can probably get through, maybe in the U.S. Senate, but that would mean that the vote tallies in the governor's race, the Agriculture Commission, and the Bonfiglio's race, that those results, they wouldn't get a recount. And instead, they would be forced to submit the results that were certified initially by last Saturday, because that's the initial deadline for counting initial votes in the state of Florida, like 3 days after the election, which is already an insanely short amount of time.
And also, not all of the mail-in ballots have arrived, for example, from overseas.
They haven't even arrived from overseas. Overseas and military voters, their ballots are not due until this Saturday, if I understand. So those ballots haven't even been counted at all. At least the stragglers that can still come in. So anyway, Booker tells the Post that she thinks they're going to go to the federal courts, well, to challenge this ruling today in Leon County. Well, going to the federal courts is exactly what the Republicans did back in 2000. As you'll recall, when the U.S. Supreme Court took the unprecedented step of intervening in a state election to effectively stop the counting and make George W. Bush the president. So far, Republicans in the state have been following that exact model. They've been creating phony, you know, declaring phony claims of fraud in Palm Beach and Broward County, for which there is zero evidence. Both of those counties being Democratic strongholds, ginning up protests outside the election supervisor's offices down there in Broward County. So I expect that playbook will continue.
Well, it worked really well last time.
Yeah, of course. And they'll try to get a favorable ruling from a federal court. Good luck with that. But for now, anyway, Palm Beach has some more time to actually count, actually machine recount paper ballots. Scott's lead right now over Bill Nelson is officially down to about 12,500 votes. DeSantis, the Republican in the governor's race, currently leads Gillum by about 33,000 votes, in both cases out of more than 8 million ballots cast. So we will continue to keep our eyes on that as that mess dumpster fire unfolds. And in some good news for Democrats in Arizona, some good news which broke shortly after we got off air yesterday. It is now official-ish. With the news that we had predicted on yesterday's show, Democrat Kirsten Nielsen. See?
Different one.
Similarly ridiculous spelling. But in any event, Democrat Kirsten Sinema won Arizona's open U.S. Senate seat, according to the people who call these things over at Associated Press, beating Republican Congresswoman Martha McSally in the battle to replace GOP Senator Jeff Flake, who is retiring. The three-term Congresswoman Sinema won after a slow vote count, as AP describes it, that dragged on for nearly a week after voters went to the polls on November 6. Oh my, nearly a week we had to wait, Desi.
The horror.
How did we make it this long? To see, you know, who actually won or lost a U.S. Senate seat that will be held for the next 6 years. It was not a slow count, AP. It was a ton of vote-by-mail ballots that could not even be counted until after Election Day, when each one of them has to be authenticated before it can be tallied. That's not a slow count. That's what happens when some 75% of voters cast ballots via mail, which is now the case in Arizona. So Sinema becomes the first Arizona's first Democratic U.S. senator since 1994. And she also becomes the first woman to represent the state as a U.S. senator ever. Her win, according to AP, cemented Arizona as a swing state after years of Republican dominance. Sinema first came to prominence as an openly bisexual Green Party activist in Phoenix. She is now a Democrat, but still bisexual, as I understand it, making her the also the first openly bi U.S. senator. So there's that. McSally, on the other hand, is a former Air Force pilot who had embraced Donald Trump after initially opposing him during the 2016 elections. She conceded defeat in a video posted on Monday night to social media. Her gracious concession, I should note, is no small thing for a Republican these days. According to Politico over the weekend, as Sinema took the lead and widened the margin over McSally, Politico reported, quote, top officials with the White House and RNC who have been prodding The McSally campaign to amp up its efforts have expressed frustration that the Arizona congresswoman hasn't tried to drive a message that there's something amiss with the vote count. So to her credit, she did not take that bait, though there may be a reason for that, which I'll get to in a moment. Don't give McSally too much credit here. In any event, during her 6 years in Congress, Sinema built one of the most centrist records in the Democratic caucus. So she's a conservative Democrat. She voted for bills that were backed by Trump more than 60% of the time, AP reports. She backed legislation increasing penalties against people in the country illegally who commit crimes. McSally's attacks, meanwhile, on Sinema reached back more than 15 years when Sinema was a Green Party spokeswoman and an anti-war activist opposed to the Iraq War. McSally, that was about all that McSally had to use against Sinema, frankly, and she used it to brand Sinema as a traitor, really, for opposing the Iraq War. Sinema attacked McSally's leadership of the of last year's failed Affordable Care Act repeal effort as a sign that she would not protect Arizona residents with pre-existing medical conditions, even as McSally argued that she would protect patients despite her vote on the bill that would have removed those protections. So the Democrats pick up a Republican U.S. Senate seat. Now, as I mentioned, McSally has been receiving these plaudits since her reasonable concession video posted last night, which she congratulated Sinema, wished her luck, said she was sorry the results didn't come out differently, but that Arizona's best days are still ahead. You know, the stuff that pretty much all candidates used to do when they lost an election. Well, she's been getting all of this credit for having done that. Josh Marshall observes on Twitter, "I give McSally credit for a graceful concession, but let's be clear, it only stands out because of the moral sludge of Trumpism in which any show of grace or honorable conduct is shocking." Which is true. I mean, it's shocking that she simply did the right thing and didn't take the White House bait to make up phony claims of voter fraud and everything else. So I guess she deserves credit for that.
Well, the bar is very low these days.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's a response to Josh said, that's how low the bar has been set on Republicans. Act decent for 5 minutes and you're a hero. Someone else replied to say, how long will it be before we praise Republicans for washing their hands after going to the bathroom? In any event, I would argue, and others I see are doing this as well today, that really the only reason that McSally didn't take the bait, that she was in any way gracious about any of this, is because that she's likely to still become a senator very soon. John Kyle, who is one of her political mentors, was appointed in September to fill the seat left vacant by the death of Senator John McCain. Kyle has said he was only going to serve through January 3, which means the state's Republican governor, Doug Ducey, who was just reelected by big numbers, that he will get to select another senator to take that seat. That person would then have to run for reelection in 2020. But Ducey had campaigned with McSally frequently last month, so it is believed that Ducey will likely tap Martha McSally to become the next U.S. senator from Arizona anyway. So really, there's nothing in it for her to go out and fight and yell and scream. She's probably going to win the U.S. Senate anyway. So there's that. For now, Arizona's Senate race, at least from last Tuesday, is settled with Dems flipping that seat, that red seat, to blue. That means Republicans have picked up, so far, just one U.S. Senate seat. But that could go to two, depending on how Florida works out. We will continue to watch that. And meanwhile, in Georgia, where there is no Senate seat at stake, the governor's election continues to be a mess, with more court rulings coming down in favor of Democrats and voting rights advocates. That dumpster fire is next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Georgia, Georgia.
Oh, Georgia.
The whole day through. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
I don't know if it's the old sweet song that keeps Georgia on my mind, but welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Not that we predicted it. Repeatedly warned about it might be a more accurate phrase here, but the fight to count votes in Georgia's governor's race is now officially an absolute mess 1 week after Election Day. As you know too well by now, the contest was one in which Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, used every vote suppressor trick in the book to try to keep certain Georgians from being able to register to vote at all, and to make it as difficult as possible for those who did manage to cast a vote to actually have their votes counted as cast. Kemp, who is running against African-American Democrat Stacey Abrams to become the Peach State's next governor, declared victory last Thursday and at the same time finally resigned as Secretary of State, which Abrams, voting rights advocates, and even former president and Georgia resident Jimmy Carter had been begging Kemp to do long ago in hopes of avoiding just some of the messes that we are now seeing in the post-election canvass period, with thousands of absentee and provisional ballots having been rejected by county officials across the state, and both the Abrams camp and voting rights advocates lining up in court to sue Brian Kemp and to sue the state and the Secretary of State's office in order to try and re-enfranchise thousands of voters and otherwise count legitimately cast ballots in hopes of something that resembles a legitimate count. We had warned over and over again before the election that that seems all but impossible at this point. According to the latest reported numbers from the Georgia Secretary of State's website, and remember, many of these numbers were from 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems that Georgia requires all voters to use at the polls when casting a normal ballot on Election Day. So the accuracy of those votes can never be adjudicated, especially with touchscreens reportedly flipping votes from Abrams to Kemp. In any event, according to the numbers that we have, Brian Kemp now reportedly leads Stacey Abrams by less than 1.5 points. Kemp has 50.26%. Stacey Abrams has 48.79%. So Kemp is now just 0.26% above what would trigger a runoff in December for this election. About 21,000 votes picked up by Abrams out of some 4 million cast would trigger such a runoff. A recount of the current race could also occur. That would be triggered if about 19,000 more votes were picked up by Abrams. All of this may be difficult, but that's what the fight is really all about, at least for the Abrams team right now in Georgia. So it's little wonder that lawsuits are now flying and have been flying for weeks and months even, as we've been covering on this program. And now with thousands of rejected provisionals and absentee ballots still said to be uncounted across the state and little idea from anyone how many were rejected for good reason, because they were fraudulent or the voter was not properly registered, or for bad reason because the voter had been wrongly removed from the voting rolls under Brian Kemp, or because a voter forgot to include their birthday on the absentee ballot envelope, or a partisan election official who is not a handwriting expert decided that a signature did not match the one that was on the voter's registration record. Anyway, to that end, Common Cause of Georgia won an important lawsuit in federal court on Monday night, announced not long after we went off air. As the New York Times reports, a federal judge on Monday delayed the certification of the results of Georgia's governor's race, citing concerns about the counting of provisional ballots and effectively deepening the turmoil surrounding one of the year's most acrimonious campaigns. In a 56-page ruling, Judge Amy Totenberg forbade Georgia's Secretary of State, Robin Crittenden. She was appointed, by the way, Secretary of State just last week after Kemp resigned late in the week when he declared victory. The judge barred Crittenden from certifying the election outcome until at least Friday evening. She also ordered Crittenden's office to immediately establish and publicize on its website a secure and free access hotline or website for provisional ballot voters to access in order to determine whether their provisional ballots were counted, and if they were not counted, provide a detailed reason to the voters as to why. In a statement released on Monday night, Sarah Henderson, the executive director of Common Cause Georgia, which filed this particular lawsuit, there's a lot of them flying right now, Sarah Henderson said, "Today's ruling is a victory for the voters of Georgia. We are all stronger when every eligible voter is allowed to participate in our elections. This victory," she said, "helps achieve greater voter confidence in our elections." Well, that, at this point, will be no easy feat in the state of Georgia. Joining us now to explain this victory, what it means, and to hopefully help me understand this ruling and the many other issues still in play as the fight continues to count all legitimate votes in Georgia, is Sarah Henderson of Common Cause Georgia, where she is also a political science professor at Clayton State University in Morrow, Georgia. Sarah Henderson, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first, as I understand it, many counties have already certified their results, but the state had planned to certify the results at the state level on Wednesday, but now they're being forced to do so no sooner than this Friday. Do I understand that math correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, our current election code states that the state does not have to certify the election results until next Tuesday. So they actually have more time than Friday, but because of the runoff, their argument is, Chris Harvey says, we need to ensure that there's no confusion. Early voting starts next week for the Secretary of State's runoff. So they wanted to immediately certify by 5 p.m. today, Wednesday. So we're hopeful that Secretary Crittenden will make the right decision and delay certification until next Tuesday when the law says that she can, when it has to be finalized, because we need every moment we can possibly get in order to look over these provisionals and count the ones that are valid.
I'm struck by the fact that early voting begins for the runoff next week. That runoff would be December 4th.
Yes.
And at this point, we don't know if there even will be a runoff. There could be one potentially in the governor's race. But sticking to the vote count for the current election that we're fighting over, doesn't the Help America Vote Act or HAVA already require states to inform provisional ballot voters and absentee rejected voters and so forth if their ballots were accepted or not? I was surprised that the judge here, Judge Totenberg, had to order the Secretary of State to set up a site all of a sudden so that provisional voters can figure out if they were counted or not this week.
Right. So, you know, so much of the burden here in Georgia is placed on the voter. And we have really, you know, cut constantly the budget at the state level for elections. And so the counties have suffered. And in essence, they don't have the proper equipment to be able to let voters know in a timely manner that their ballot was rejected. People are still receiving rejected absentee ballots today. And they could have had time to, you know, contest that ballot. And these are folks that mailed it in several weeks ago. We're not talking about someone that showed up on election day. So we have an antiquated system, and to the extent that the 159 counties are all in charge of their elections, I can tell you from firsthand experience that is not the case, that the state controls everything about our elections process. And this whole circus that we're witnessing is just a product of years and years of defunding elections.
It really is a circus at this point. What will the Secretary of State, I know the judge has ordered now the Secretary of State to review or have county election officials review in all counties all of the provisional ballots to determine if they were rejected because of registration issues. But if they were already rejected, what will the Secretary of State or the county election officials actually be looking at in such a review? Do you understand?
Well, yes. So those rejected provisional ballots are not thrown away or shredded.
Mm-hmm.
Those are kept until the state certifies the election. And in some cases, they're kept for 2 years, for 24 months.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about having to go dig through garbage cans. I mean, these are, you know, we're looking at roughly a little over 21,000 ballots and that were cast due to voter registration issues. So, yeah, the county officials are going to have to go back. They're going to have to review these. And they're going to have to recertify after they've corrected the vote totals.
There was about 5,000 votes, as I understand it, that were added to the totals over the weekend, primarily in Abrams' favor. I'm confused about whether where those votes actually came from. Were those newly discovered votes, or were these some of those rejected absentees and provisionals that election officials had gone back to, perhaps because they had allegedly mismatched signatures that voters were able to cure? Most of those votes, of those 5,000 votes, I think, fell in Abrams' favor. Do we know where are those votes coming from before we get to the 21,000 that you just mentioned?
Well, those votes are primarily coming from counties who were counting over the weekend, counting provisional ballots. And also, you know, Secretary of State Crittenden has issued to the counties that they need to accept any absentee ballot, even if it didn't have birth dates on the application.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this administrative action from the SOS, and that has increased the numbers as well. So counties are still, in fact, Fulton County, the largest county in the state, is just certifying this afternoon their election results. So they were granted an extension because they did have four polling locations open till 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
on election night, and they have had numerous issues with provisional and absentee ballots as well. So those are going to continue to change. And again, this goes back to our antiquated system. You have to call each county office to find out how many provisional ballots were cast at that particular in that particular county.
Mm-hmm.
Even the state has to do that. So there's not a system of reporting that's standardized that we can really, you know, get that information faster.
As noted, Stacey Abrams would need to pick up about 21,000 votes in order to force that runoff in December in the governor's race. About 19,000 vote pickup. There would be a recount, or at least what suffices for one in Georgia, which with, as I said, those 100% unverifiable touchscreen votes cast across the state. So recounting those is largely meaningless. But are there enough votes uncounted, rejected, or otherwise questionable out there to actually move the needle as much as would be required to either trigger a runoff or a recount? Or is everyone just sort of guessing at it at this point?
Well, I will say this, and this has been my contention from the moment we filed this suit the day before the election.
Mm-hmm.
It's the gubernatorial race is extremely important, obviously. But we have, just for an example, three state house races in Metro Atlanta, Cobb, Fulton, and Gwinnett that are within 300 votes.
Right.
So, you know, and we're also looking at, we've got four constitutional amendments that passed. So, you know, looking at all of that stuff, and we encourage Judge Sotenberg to pay attention to that as well, not get totally hung up on the gubernatorial, because we don't know. We don't know how many votes are out there, and we're still waiting for that information.
So the fight over these governor races ballots could affect some of these House races that are still undecided if voters are able to come in some way or another cure their ballots, or county officials are ordered to count these provisionals that they had tossed out. As I understand, in your lawsuit, Sarah Henderson, Common Cause Georgia had charged that Brian Kemp himself is responsible for much of this mess. Of course, we know he's responsible for a lot of the mess, but specifically regarding this vulnerability that was discovered just before Election Day on the state's My Voter Registration page. We discussed that just before the election. It apparently allowed anybody to actually be able to go online and actually change other voters' registrations, even delete some of them. That had been kept sort of on the down low when it was discovered. Democrats notified Kemp's office about it, but he himself publicized that vulnerability loudly, claiming the Democrats were trying to hack the voter registration database. How is Common Cause arguing that that public charge by Brian Kemp played into this whole mess?
Well, I mean, it just points out what we've said for over a decade, that there are vulnerabilities in the system that need to be corrected immediately. And, this goes to the whole, let me point out the Democratic Party of Georgia, because I am, essentially running against them to be governor. He did the same thing to Logan Lamb, who was one of the key witnesses in several cases related to our voting machines here in Georgia. So he, and that's why it's so hard for us to do this work in the state. Well, it was under Kemp as Secretary of State, because he victimizes his office and he makes us look like we are the ones that are, sort of being critical and coming after him for whatever reason. But the Democratic Party of Georgia, there was no hacking attempt. But it really illuminated the situation and how really dire it is that we correct this problem. And offering 6 months of credit monitoring is not going to cut it this time. We've got to protect these voter files.
Is there a fear that, in fact, that vulnerability did allow some people to change voter registrations for others, for other voters and so forth? Do we have any sense? Has there been any sort of forensic analysis of, whether voter registrations were changed before the election thanks to that vulnerability on the Secretary of State's website?
We wouldn't know. The Secretary of State's office claims that they have five different third-party vendors who are, in charge of security and cybersecurity. But I don't trust what they have. It's not transparent who the vendors even are. So we wouldn't know. And that's what's so sad about the whole situation is, that the whole function of your office is to help engage voters and make sure that they have access to the polls. When all you're doing is trying to, put up roadblocks all the time, that's a huge problem. And another reason that we should have a nonpartisan Secretary of State in Georgia.
And yet we're about to see a runoff between a Democrat and a Republican for Secretary of State coming up in December. And who knows whether there'll be one for governor's office or not. AP also reports that the Abrams campaign is now asking that any of the court's orders in the case, I think this is speaking about your case. There are so many lawsuits going on right now. I'm having trouble keeping up in Georgia. I can only imagine what you are. But the Abrams campaign is asking that the court's orders in the case be applied retroactively to counties that have already certified their returns, meaning those counties would have to reopen their counting process using any of the new standards that are coming out of these lawsuits. Has the judge, Judge Totenberg, yet ruled on that? Are these all of these counties, even if they have certified, now having to go back and recheck all rejected absentees, provisionals, et cetera?
Well, our order says that the counties have to go back and check the provisionals, marked PR, which means provisional registration. So any absentee ballot, any envelope that has PR on there, or not absentee, I'm sorry, provisional ballot, has to be reviewed again. So essentially, Totenberg, in her opinion that was issued last night, says, look, these certifications at the county level, while, they can continue to certify, they are going to have to go back and look at this. This is, what I say stands type of thing. And the, the Secretary of State, again, has ultimate authority to, accept recertifications, to not accept certifications from counties. And it's really the certification at the state level that is most important.
Boy, what a mess. I think some good news, however, from those, a little bit of good news from those court rulings. I note that Kristen Clark, the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under Law, the director over there, she noted very happily that the in Gwinnett County, there was where there was a mass rejection of absentee ballots based on omitted or incorrect birth years, that violates the Civil Rights Act and that those ballots must now be counted. That adds another 1,000 or so ballots, I think, to the count out of Gwinnett County and perhaps around the state. Are you guys still waiting, Sarah Henderson, for additional rulings from this judge? Do you expect the process to go smoothly from here on out? Or, in other words, what is next at this point for you guys?
Well, we're working with the state to ensure that the hotline is up and running, that we can try to offer our ideas and suggestions to make this as easy and smooth as possible. So we're just trying to continue to gather information from our discovery that was due several hours ago, but trying to get all of that information and synthesize it in a way that we can reach out and start educating the public, because we technically have a little over 2 days, not too much time to get this done.
No, you don't. I should let you go so you can do that. Sarah Henderson, Executive Director at Common Cause Georgia. You can find them, follow them, support them on the Twitters at Common Cause GA and on their website, commoncause.org/Georgia. Sarah Henderson, greatly appreciate you joining us today. Good luck in this continuing fight, and please stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Holy moly. What a mess.
Yeah, it's
what
crazy. Makes me wonder, when will the people of Georgia rise up to change this system?
Yeah, actually, they are rising up, and a state senator, I think it was arrested in protests outside. I'm not sure if it was outside the Secretary of State's office or the state capitol in Georgia today. But man, what a mess. But of course, we told you this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it is happening.
Gotta
and it is
it
a
now.
Mess. And Kemp is just going to keep muscling his way through to becoming an illegitimate governor of the state of Georgia, if that's what it takes. Apparently, he doesn't give a damn. All right, quick break. And we are back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Don't touch that dial. Oh, yeah. And then there's climate change and global warming that doesn't seem to give a damn about elections.
Nope. Politics is not its thing. It doesn't care.
No, it doesn't. And it has been, once again, particularly deadly out here in California. As noted in our latest Green News Report.
This latest round of fires is the most destructive in California state history.
The most destructive and now the most deadly. Kids' landmark climate lawsuit against the federal government on hold yet again. Plus,
it was a political decision made by a judge. I think it's a disgrace.
Judge halts all work on controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Donald Trump is sad.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
48,000 jobs. I approved it. It's ready to start.
48,000 jobs on the Keystone XL pipeline. Really? Why not just say 48 million jobs? Why not 48 quadrillion jobs? They're all lies. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, having some fun at Trump's sad, pathetic expense. Unfortunately, however, first, we've got to get to some very sad news out here in California.
Yes, California is again grappling with record-breaking, catastrophic, deadly wildfires. Three major fires now burning in both Northern and Southern California that, as of airtime, have killed more than 40 people combined and forced more than 300,000 to evacuate. The largest of the fires, the Camp Fire in Northern California, went from spark to the most destructive fire in state history in just 48 hours. As of Monday, it became the deadliest as well in state history. Driven by extremely dry weather and high winds, it spread at the speed of 80 football fields a minute, faster than many could evacuate. More than 200 people are still unaccounted for, nearly 7,000 structures destroyed, most of them homes. The state's previous record for the most destructive fire was set just last year.
And of course, like last year, Donald Trump is claiming that all of this is because of forest mismanagement or some other nonsense. Any truth to that?
Absolutely not. State and local fire officials have rejected those tweets by President Trump that were attacking California and wrongly blaming forest management for the deadly fires. Brian Rice, president of the California Professional Firefighters Association, called Trump's comments, quote, reckless and dangerously wrong.
Yeah, I suppose all those folks who live on the beach in Malibu would be shocked to hear that it's because of forest mismanagement that has threatened their homes.
In the middle of an urban area.
Right.
No official cause for the fires has been determined yet, but state regulators on Monday said they are investigating utility companies, Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison, which both reported equipment failures in the vicinities of all three fires just minutes before each fire began. PG&E is already facing billions of dollars in liability after state agency Cal Fire determined that PG&E's equipment was the cause of those several deadly catastrophic Northern California wildfires last year. But California's outgoing Democratic Governor Jerry Brown, in a press conference on Monday, placed the blame squarely on climate change, noting that fire season has now become a year-round threat in the state.
This is not the new normal. This is the new abnormal. And this new abnormal will continue, certainly in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. And unfortunately, the best science is telling us that dryness, warmth, drought, all those things, they're going to intensify.
In other news, the sweeping, historic climate lawsuit brought by a group of kids against the federal government is on hold again, just days after the U.S. Supreme Court lifted a temporary stay on the trial. 21 children and young adults under the age of 22 are suing the federal government, saying its failure to act on climate change is a violation of their constitutional rights to life and liberty. Late last week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals again halted that trial, which had been slated to start in late October. The judges ruled the Trump Department of Justice, quote, raises issues that warrant an answer. The children's lawyers must file a reply by November 23rd. Finally, a federal judge has ordered both the Trump administration and TransCanada to stop all work on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, ruling that President Trump's approval of the pipeline's cross-border permit last year violated several key environmental and administrative laws. The judges ruled that the administration simply discarded climate facts in its analysis supporting the pipeline. Quote, an agency cannot simply disregard contrary or inconvenient factual determinations on climate change. The State Department must now complete a new supplemental environmental impact statement that accounts for the effects of climate change and the impacts of potential oil spills on Native American tribal resources.
So they can't just change policy because they want to. They actually have to show that there's evidence to support good reason for changing this policy?
Exactly.
Well, what about 48,000 new jobs that would be created, as Donald Trump said?
Why not 40 billion?
Exactly. In truth, how many jobs are we talking about for the KXL?
Less than 4,000 temporary jobs, only 35 permanent jobs.
35 permanent jobs.
Mm-hmm.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. I think that's one of the hardest parts of this job right now is just keeping up with
the toxic sludge tsunami of lies.
Of lies.
Indeed, yeah. It is.
I mean, and figuring out which ones are even worth responding to and which ones are worth ignoring.
Yeah, it's just too much.
It's amazing. You said on that Keystone XL, by the way, you had a point you wanted to...
Yes, just one quick follow-up that TransCanada, the pipeline developer and owner, says that it is still committed to following through on construction of the Keystone XL. So this fight's going to go on for a while.
And will they even have the customers for it? The last I heard, they weren't even sure that they could that it was worth them doing.
It's a good question. And their investors are asking... We'll see what they decide to end up doing.
Well, now they're going to do it if only because they don't want to make Donald Trump look like a chump, which, good luck.
Too late.
Right. All right. Thank you very much to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Sarah Henderson of Common Cause Georgia, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's thrilling broadcast, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast download site. We always appreciate if you can leave a nice comment or a good rating for us. That helps other people find our work as well here. You can drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. Find, follow, and share us there. And my thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. I know we have to sort of say it every day here, but you really are the folks who keep us on the air as we struggle to stay on your public airwaves. We don't rely on political groups or corporations to continue to do what we do. We rely only on you, and we really need you to keep going. Please consider getting a subscription of any amount you like or making a one-time donation at bradblog.com/donate. That's it. Until we meet again tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.